Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Carnegis, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is a man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Yes, all votes of the committee are unanimous, and they were unanimous in asking you and me to be on this one.
That's convenient.
Yeah, works well that way.
So it's that time again for another round of Ask Me Anything. Both Ken and I have been getting a steady stream of questions the past few months, and I must say the questions for this round are really good.
They are, Don. They're quite good. And ever since we started doing these Ask Me Anything episodes, we've been getting an ever-increasing amount of questions in our inboxes.
Yeah, some interesting ones, too.
Yeah, some more interesting than others.
But before Ken and I start answering your questions, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful 5-star reviews. As always, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to rate on STEM Talk. If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the cryptic moniker N7965W. The review is titled Value Beyond Price. It reads, "This podcast gives the incredible opportunity to listen as some of the greatest minds in the field are probed in a format that is completely accessible, and it's free for the taking. Wow."
Well, thank you, N7965W, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who've helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to our listeners' questions.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Don Carnegis, and joining me is Ken Ford.
Hello, Don.
So we are doing another Ask Me Anything today, so we're going to get started here. So, okay, here is a timely question that came in last month. What does Dr. Ford think about social distancing?
Oh, boy. So, again, this is my personal view. It actually may be quite a dumb policy, but it is certainly a ridiculous term. So, just as a term, think of what social distancing means. I think if you really want to social distance, you should get off Facebook and stop texting all your friends. But, of course, that will have nothing to do with the spread of the virus. What we're really talking about is physical distancing. I'll leave it to the listener to determine if it's a dumb policy, but it's certainly a dumb term.
I agree. I think, if anything, a lot of us have become less socially distanced in terms of communication with family and friends through other means that are not physical. So I agree with you on that one.
Okay. Another COVID-related item, and this is a question for Don. Related to COVID-19, there has been discussion about long-term pulmonary health in individuals who have been infected, and one hears quite a bit about this in the news. How will these long-term effects impact divers such as yourself or those who go to altitude, for example? Are there any particular effects?
So that's a great question. It's definitely something that's been coming up. Still, obviously, we're pretty early on in this, so we're still learning a lot about what the virus does to individuals and the long-term health effects, especially, again, because we're so early into the disease trend itself. But right now, there has been communication coming out from the diving medicine community and also the altitude medicine community that there is concern about long-term impact to the lungs, not just in individuals who have been severely affected, but even individuals who may have had necessarily super mild, but you know, mild to moderate forms of the virus. So it's definitely something that we're learning more about. And I think it's going to be an important thing for people to pay attention to from diver health perspective and also for individuals going to altitude. I know there's concern about pilots, for example, who have been hospitalized. So people who've had severe forms of the infection, which makes sense, right? So you're talking about it as a pulmonary infection. So you would have that concern with any type of pulmonary infection, not just COVID. So still a lot to learn, but it's definitely something that the community is going to have to pay attention to as we move forward and get to a place where people can be doing things like flying and diving again here soon. A listener sent this question for you. During your interview with Catherine Eben, you made a comment about how current events related to COVID-19 truly highlight the fault in our dependency on Chinese manufacturing for our pharmaceuticals. That was just a few months ago. So, I mean, we were talking about this pretty early on. Where do you see our relationship with China heading with respect to drug manufacturing in the future?
That's a great question. And, you know, in a nutshell, overseas manufacturing of the vast majority of our generic pharmaceuticals, especially in places like China and India, coupled with a completely inadequate FDA inspection process, has put millions of Americans at risk, due both to supply chain interruptions, intentional and otherwise, as well as tainted drugs itself and drugs that are manufactured inappropriately. So I think there's significant risk here, and this COVID experience has really pointed it out. Although this should be a wake-up call, to be woken up, one must be asleep. And I fear that as a society, we're not asleep, but relatively comatose and will be hard to arouse. The listener asked about where I see this going. And, you know, when you look at the whole generic drug phenomena, drug prices are politically more important than drug quality. Drug pricing is driving this, and it's a highly political issue, and it would be good if the media covered this issue with insight and depth. The notable exception you mentioned, Don, is Catherine Eben. Mm-hmm. Just spectacular investigative reporting of the kind you just don't see much anymore, but she certainly gives investigative reporters a good name. Now, at this point, where we are in this is that each individual has to take responsibility, as difficult as it is, for the quality of the pharmaceuticals they ingest. And typically, it's hard for us to do that as individuals. There are several resources online. We talked about them in Catherine Eben's interview, including her website, which has a lot of good information about generic drugs. Also, there's a pharmacy called Valisure. We don't have any financial relationship with either of them, of course. And it's a mail order pharmacy. But the nice thing is they test every batch of drugs that they dispense. And so they're doing it right there. They're essentially doing the FDA's job for them, I'm sure at a fraction of the cost. And we will include a link in our show notes. Well, here we have a question for Don. And the listener is no doubt very pleased to hear that Don has started eating fish after being a strict vegetarian for 25 years. Was this decision due to some of the discussions that you and Don and the others have had on STEM Talk, or did it come from some other place?
Great question. Thanks, Ken. It had a little bit to do with all of the above. So some of the conversations we had on STEM Talk, some of the conversations I've had with Ken, and some of the notes and the poking and prodding I get every once in a while from Ken, all from a kind nature, because he wants me to be healthy. And then individuals that we work with, such as Joe Gomes and his wife Ashley, and other individuals who have a lot of expertise in looking at proper nutrition. Big part, I was training for a marathon, which is a whole other note that we could talk about, but I was training for a marathon and I noticed that I was just really fatigued. And I think as I'm getting a little bit older, my body isn't as resilient as it used to be to some of the endurance training, which I did have a background in, especially from the swimming perspective. So decided to start increasing my protein intake and everything else that you get along with seafood. And especially living in the Pensacola area, you've got incredible fresh seafood every single day that's local. So what better place to take advantage of that and make sure that my nutrition is proper. So that is why I started to eat fish again.
Great answer, I think.
I think just as a note, the first week that I let everyone know here that I was eating fish, we had meetings every day. And so we had lunches that were catered, and every single one of those lunches had a huge serving of fish. So I had pretty much made up for my fish lacking for the past probably year in 1 week. So that was good.
Yes. Are those gills I see on the side of your neck?
It's maybe a better swimmer. So a STEM Talk listener asks, does Ken use branched-chain amino acids? And if so, how does he use them?
Well, first, just real quick, a little background on amino acids. And I think the vast majority of our listeners are pretty up to speed on this, so I'll just do this real quickly. You know, the protein we consume in our diet, including Don's fish, is broken down into 20 amino acids in our digestive tract. And these amino acids are colloquially and commonly referred to as the building blocks of life, or the stuff that we're made out of, because amino acids provide the physical structure of our bodies, in addition to lots of other critical functions that we'll save for another day. Among these 20 amino acids, 9 of them are referred to as the essential amino acids. Essential in this case, meaning that our body cannot produce these amino acids at a rate commensurate with its demand. Thus, they must be supplied in our diet or through supplementation. Among the 9 essential amino acids that we cannot synthesize are the 3 branched chain amino acids that the listener asked about, and these are leucine, isoleucine, and valine. Now, leucine plays a particularly critical role in recovery post-exercise and essentially plays the key role in signaling the body to switch from a catabolic state, like you're in during exercise, to an anabolic state. And research has further shown that although leucine can be thought of as the trigger, all of the essential amino acids should be present in the bloodstream for an optimal repair and recovery. What's recent is the appreciation that one needs all the essential amino acids, not just the branched chain amino acids. And as we've discussed in earlier STEM Talk episodes, the way leucine and the amino acids facilitate this anabolic state is largely through the activation of mTOR. And we'll come back to mTOR briefly. As we discussed earlier in STEM Talk, aging, and Dawn just mentioned getting older, though she's hardly aged, as we age, we become typically increasingly anabolically resistant. We're resistant to the stimulus that, when we were young, produced an anabolic effect. In particular, as we age, we tend to be resistant to the effects of exercise and protein ingestion. And this is partly why you hear the recommendation for older people to ingest more protein, not less. So combining essential amino acid supplementation with mechanical loading via resistance training is a powerful strategy, in my view, to combat the age-related loss of muscle function and mass that one sees and often leads to sarcopenia in the older population. These two stimuli, the essential amino acids and mechanical loading, are particularly interesting, and they strongly activate mTOR, but through different mechanisms. So you get a stronger mTOR activation than by either alone. You get increased protein synthesis and eventually more muscle growth. Particularly with respect to older people, research has shown that ingesting a leucine-enriched amino acid mixture after a bout of relatively intense resistance exercise found both mTOR activation and prolonged myofibrillar protein synthesis for up to 24 hours after the resistance training. In contrast, when you take away the essential amino acids and apply the same exercise stimulus, the anabolic response remained blunted in these older men. More recently, a related and equally interesting 2017 paper by Reedy showed that post-exercise essential amino acid supplementation amplified skeletal muscle satellite cell proliferation, essentially muscle stem cells, in older men. So, our listener asked if I use branched-chain amino acids. As is probably clear by now, the answer is yes, but not in isolation, apart from all the other necessary amino acids. And that's real important. In fact, there's a whole industry selling branched chain amino acids without the other essential amino acids. A 2017 meta-analysis authored by Robert Wolf reported that a physiologically significant increase in the rate of muscle protein synthesis absolutely requires adequate availability of all amino acid precursors, not just the branched chain ones. So yes, I ingest essential amino acids pre-workout, during training, in my drinking water, and post-resistance training. There is some muscle biopsy evidence based on a relatively small study that pre-workout supplementation is more beneficial than post-workout if one had to prioritize. But, you know, these things are uncertain, and I'll just like to have it both ways. Personally, I like 2 essential amino acid blends. These are, again, leucine-enriched blends. These are not equal parts of each amino acid. One is called the master amino acid pattern, MAP, and the other is called mass pro synthogen. But they both are thoughtful amino acid blends of all the essential amino acids.
Fantastic. Just as a quick aside, I think that that question has come through a couple of times, Ken, with respect to branched chain amino acids. I've even had people ask me to ask you that. So,
Good. I was afraid my answer was too long, but if it's come through a few times.
Yes. No, that's hugely helpful. So this question comes from Panhandle Southpaw, which is a great name, by the way.
Yeah, you got to love that name.
The more I listen to STEM Talk, the more questions I have. Like, after listening to John Newman talk about ketogenic diets and fasting, it's interesting how so many nutritionists disparage a ketogenic diet, but are all on board when it comes to time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting. But don't you go into ketosis when you fast? So what's the difference? Why is one way of getting into ketosis better than any other? At any rate, this is my long-winded way of saying it is time for another Ask Me Anything episode. Keep up the great work. So we're tackling that last part, but maybe you can tackle the questions, Ken.
Okay, Don. Yes, of course, it can certainly matter how you get into ketosis. For lunch, we could go eat a can of Crisco and nothing else, and I would be in ketosis for sure, and probably pretty unhealthy.
Probably feel terrible.
So it does matter, but his question is more nuanced than that. I presume it's a him, maybe not. Panhandle Southpaw, I love that name. Yes, I mean, his question really isn't whether it matters how you get in ketosis as much as why do nutritionists loudly denigrate the diet for the most part and praise fasting when they both put you in ketosis. So that is, I think, the heart of his question. And, you know, there's really several reasons. First, most nutritionists have been taught their entire life that the consumption of fat is bad. Eat fat, be fat, die of heart disease and cancer too. That's how the song goes. At least that's the first verse of the song. There are other verses. Fasting makes no necessary commitment to what one would eat. Just don't eat. So fasting is very easy to explain to their clients, right? It's not eat this, don't eat this. They don't have to advocate people eating fat. They can avoid talking about protein, which is their other favorite boogeyman. And, you know, they can also avoid discussion of meat in general and advocate for a plant-based diet. So I think there's a lot going on there. It's not just the ketosis issue. It's that a ketogenic diet in their minds, I think, implies a high-fat diet, which it certainly does, and fat faintly terrorizes them. And then on top of that, it implies the consumption of animal products, which isn't necessary, but it's certainly the common way to do it. So I think those are the reasons for this reaction.
So there's another question from a listener for you, Ken. You were an early adoptee of the low-carb and ketogenic diets based upon substantial research, some of it decades old. So how has your understanding of low-carb and healthy diets overall changed as research has progressed over recent years?
Well, the listener is right. I've been interested in ketogenic diets and the role of ketone bodies for a long, long time. The listener is interested in what has piqued my interest in recent years, say the last, 7 to 10 years. I'm to the point in life where 7 to 10 years is recent. So for me, I think the role of ketone bodies as a very effective, mobile, and highly efficient energy source, as the listener says, has long been appreciated. The energy role, really well appreciated, well understood in scientific circles. But in recent years, we've seen that many of the most interesting and potentially important effects of ketones are not those arising only from their energetic properties, but rather from signaling functions of the circulating ketones themselves, acting almost like hormones and as signaling agents. In particular, I find this research fascinating, and it's identified a whole array of signaling functions of beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate that suggests they might regulate inflammation and gene expression with significant implications for health and longevity. In particular, I'd like to point the listener to work from Verdon's lab and others, which we have previously discussed on earlier episodes of STEM Talk, but in a nutshell, what excites me in the last decade or so in particular about ketone bodies is their ability to act as signaling agents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And a listener writes, I have been trying time-restricted eating. I mostly skip breakfast and have lunch around 11 or noon and try to finish dinner by 8, but I've been slipping into nighttime binging and eating up until 9 or 10 at night. It seems like a number of the people you interview about time-restricted eating skip breakfast, but a friend told me that it's difficult to suppress ghrelin, the hunger hormone, if you skip breakfast. To be honest, I have never heard of ghrelin. What can you tell me about ghrelin, and is it better to skip lunch than breakfast?
Well, our listener has posed an interesting question, and it's a question I've received before. His version of the question is sufficiently coherent and pithy that we decided to cover it. So I'm one of those people that often skips breakfast, and I like to have a nice long period of fasting, not every day, but maybe 3 or 4 days a week, 3 days a week. And I get a nice long period of fasting if I skip breakfast. And if previously I'd had an early dinner, it's relatively painless fasting. In fact, I did this today. And as I said, I enjoy then eating an early dinner. You know, I fast until about noon the next day. The others may find a different schedule works better for their lifestyle, but it works for me. Now, back to the question. Clearly, I'm not concerned about intermittent fasting elevating my ghrelin levels. A little background on ghrelin, as the listener said they were unfamiliar with it. It's a circulating hormone produced in our GI tract. And in the media, it's often called the hunger hormone because elevated ghrelin can increase perceptions of hunger. Hence the concern, and I think it's where his friend's comment came from. If you don't eat, you would think that ghrelin would go up and you would become hungry, right? And of course, ghrelin has many other important functions other than regulation of hunger, but we'll save that for another day. So what does research show on this topic? Research shows that cortisol and ghrelin have essentially an inverse relationship with each other, including while fasting. So when you awake in the morning, cortisol is peak, ghrelin is at the bottom. And this inverse relationship with cortisol explains why we see the effects we do see. So when cortisol is high, ghrelin is low, and vice versa. In general, research shows that fasting does not elevate ghrelin, but lowers it. And this may explain why most people do not report strong hunger impulses when fasting. Now, you're hungry if you don't eat, but when you're fasting and you have elevated blood ketones and you're into your fast, most people do not report significant hunger. But a good way to understand the effects of ghrelin is to appreciate the inverse relationship with cortisol. So in the morning, your cortisol will peak, your ghrelin is low, you should not be particularly hungry. Throughout the day, as you fast and into the next day, if you continue to fast, you'll see ghrelin go up and down inversely as cortisol follows its daily cycle, but the trend will be an up and down pattern down. So it goes up and down, but on a downward slope. And this is what ghrelin does when you fast. A listener asked Dawn, in your podcast with Francisco González Lima, you talked briefly about the potential role of methylene blue in protecting individuals exposed to environmental hypoxia. Do you know of any studies that have looked at this potential application of methylene blue? As an aside, if listeners would like to know more about methylene blue in general and its many potential applications, I recommend that you listen to our most recent episode, episode 107, with Dr. Francisco González Lima, where we discuss methylene blue in more detail. But for the question about hypoxia, over to you, Don.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. And that was a great interview and a great discussion with Francisco. So highly recommend taking a listen to that. I know as we were talking to him, Ken and I both looked at each other and said, well, there could be potential application for environmental hypoxia, which is something that we study here at IHMC when it comes to human performance. So we actually started kind of digging into the literature after that podcast just to see what else is out there. So we know that there has been a look at different potential clinical applications for clinical hypoxia, so things like hypoxia ischemia, for example, in the clinical setting. But that's even been pretty limited. But as far as environmental hypoxia, the only thing that we've been able to find to date have been studies looking at either in vitro studies, so looking at cell cultures and how they respond to hypoxic exposure, or a few animal studies. And so far, they all look very promising as far as methylene blue being protective in the hypoxic setting. So a question that we'll have at IHMC and that we would like to actually address is, if you look at methylene wearing blue in individuals as a prophylactic strategy before somebody goes into a hypoxic environment, does that protect against the cognitive decline that you see in those individuals when they're exposed to hypoxia over a certain period of time? So it's definitely something we would like to look at in humans moving forward. It's a great question.
And a good answer, too.
Thank you.
Don, is my tongue blue?
Yes. Methylene blue?
Methylene blue, baby.
It is blue, blue, blue. When did you do that?
I've been playing around with it for a while. It's interesting. And if you...
Is that like permanent? Is that like perma-blue?
I certainly hope not. But it also makes other things blue. If you go to the bathroom, people, you definitely want to flush the toilet or they'll think you're a Martian.
A couple times. We'll know when the toilets here at IHMC are staying blue.
It'd be a new cleaning man or something.
So we actually had one of our researchers, we had methylene blue for, it was in placebo, I think, that we had, like a very tiny dose, like a tiny dollop of it for something that we were doing. And one of our researchers probably consumed a little more than he should have. And so he said it took a little while for that to resolve.
It does.
Back to normal.
That's how they used to dye blue jeans.
Yeah, yeah.
They actually used methylene blue, and fish tanks often have it in it to make the water look lovely and blue. Hmm. But one should not ingest the methylene blue that's used in fish tanks.
No, no.
No. At least your problems would be a blue tongue.
That is a very blue tongue, too. Okay. So next we have a question from a listener named Valerie. She says, so we understand that the ketogenic diet eliminates quote-unquote, good unprocessed foods like beans and whole grains. Is there a way to include at least some beans into the ketogenic diet without losing the benefits? I'm asking not as an athlete or soldier, just for myself and a group of friends. We certainly have lost weight on the ketogenic diet and wonder if it's something that we must follow forever. And we wonder whether, if we add legumes, if not whole grains, we can expect our weight to return. What are your thoughts on this, Ken?
Oh, boy. It's quite a question. So Valerie asks about the ketogenic diet eliminating, quote, good unprocessed foods like beans and whole grains. So first, from my perspective, neither of those foods should be characterized as, quote, good. I consume them very sparingly, if at all. First, whole grains and legumes are normally greatly restricted in ketogenic diets simply because of their carbohydrate load, quite apart from other reasons. And I think most people following a ketogenic diet are aware of the need to avoid grains and that healthy whole grains is mostly a marketing slogan. So, what about legumes? Apart from the associated carbohydrates, is there something about legumes? She asked pointedly about legumes, about beans. So let's look at that. The reasons one normally hears apart from carbohydrate load to avoid legumes are two things, lectins and phytic acid. These are essentially defense mechanisms for the plant. For us, we can consider them anti-nutrients, and all the animals that consume these plants suffer from consuming the anti-nutrients. Now, you have to remember that this mechanism assumes that you're eating the beans raw. In the case of beans, legumes in general, if you soak them for a substantial period of time, which is the traditional thing to do with beans, and if you also cook them in clean water, not the water you soak them in, much of this is removed and deactivated. So the hazard that one would have by eating raw legumes is tremendously mitigated by both soaking and cooking, particularly pressure cooking. And there's a big literature on this, and I won't go over it here. There are other places where one can learn about it. But in a nutshell, sure, you know, you can have some legumes and still be on the ketogenic diet as long as you don't have so many legumes that you kick yourself out of ketosis by consuming too much carbohydrate. And it's okay to go out of ketosis now and then. It's probably good for you. And, you know, I hesitate to tell anyone how to eat. I'm just sharing my thoughts on it. So I would not fear legumes if they're prepared properly and eaten in small quantities, but I recommend skipping the healthy whole grains largely altogether. STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So this is another one for you. It says, I really enjoyed Matt Johnson's interview about human and machine teaming. It got me to thinking about IHMC and its name, the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. How did you come up with the name, and what all does human and machine cognition entail?
Yes, when I first cooked this name up in 1990, I was told it was the most unpoetic name ever, and it would certainly lead to our failure. But it seemed to me like a wonderful name. At the time, I was working mostly in artificial intelligence, so I was interested in machine cognition. But IHMC is an interdisciplinary laboratory. There are computer scientists, but they're also biologists and all kinds of other people here, psychologists. And they were interested more in human cognition and how to understand human cognition and improve human cognition. And so as we thought about it, this lab is really in the boundary space in many ways between humans and machines. And we were interested in cognition apart from the particular physical manifestation of the cognizer. So we were interested in cognition in the early days of IHMC itself, not necessarily the physical substrate that supports the cognition in either human or machine. And this is how we came to have that name. And at this point, most people know us just as IHMC. But also quite unpoetic, but so be it. So here's another question for Don. When you study performance in extreme environments, how do you effectively replicate those extreme environmental conditions in a lab setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do everything from undersea to outer space simulation, I guess, here at IHMC. So we study performance, and again, undersea at altitude and trying to simulate what happens in space. So obviously, the best condition would be in the field, but there's a lot of variability there. It's tricky to try to do any measurements in the field, just a lot of different nuances to try and do field-based studies, although it's probably going to have the highest fidelity, comparatively speaking. But the question is about replicating this in the laboratory. So for diving, we have a number of different models. So depending on what it is that we want to look at specific to diving, we can do immersion, so either head-out immersion, or we can do full immersion with a scuba setup. We can do hyperbaric conditions and even hyperbaric with immersions. There are specific facilities around the country that allow us to do those kind of studies. For hypoxia, it gets a little bit easier in the sense that we don't have to have a water-based facility or any kind of pressure facilities, typically, but we can use things like a reduced oxygen breathing device, which we use for a lot of our studies here at IHMC, which is essentially a mask-based system where an individual breathes off of a machine that dials in the amount of oxygen they're breathing to simulate a certain altitude. So higher altitude that you're simulating, the less oxygen that you're going to be breathing. And so the people eventually go to some degree of hypoxia as they breathe off of this machine. We also have what's called a reduced oxygen breathing environment. So this is kind of like a room or a chamber that doesn't have changes in pressure, but just has changes in the gas that's inside. And so individuals, again, can simulate what altitude they're going to be breathing at using this chamber. So they essentially just kind of scrub out the oxygen so that you have more nitrogen, less oxygen, and that's going to equate to what you would be breathing at altitude. And that's really nice for when we do studies that include things like exercise at altitude, because an individual doesn't have to be wearing a heavy mask-based system with lots of hoses. They can just be in that environment like they would be at altitude, and they can run on a treadmill or ride a bike. And so you'll see these for training, actually. A lot of individuals who use hypoxic training for adaptation will use reduced oxygen breathing environments, and we use them here for certain studies at IHMC. You can also have hypoxic chambers as well. So obviously that's going to have reduced oxygen and reduced pressure like you would have at altitude. And then for space, it gets a little bit tricky too. And again, it depends on what it is that you're looking at. So if you're looking at the impact of microgravity on the body, we have things like head down tilt, which has been shown to be one way to simulate what happens in microgravity when you're in a ground-based scenario. They do bed rest. So they'll do bed rest, just people laying flat for 30 or 60 days, sometimes shorter, sometimes a little bit longer. But you also have head down tilt bed rest, which we've talked about before in previous podcasts, because we've been working in the past with a study that was being conducted using 60-day head down tilt bed rest, which to me, the people who are doing that study are Wow, is all I can say. They also have things like dry immersion. So that's for more acute studies. So you can do simulation of microgravity with immediate head down tilt, but you can also do dry immersion. So somebody's in the water, but their body isn't in contact with the water itself. So you get similar fluid shifts with a dry immersion scenario. Essentially, they're kind of wrapped in almost like a tarp when they go into this pressure surrounded environment in the water and their head out. And then also things like isolation. So that's a big component for space. And so they have a number of different scenarios, both more short term, like for a month. There's an analog over at NASA, Johnson Space Center, called HERA. And so they have individuals that are going in there for anywhere from 30 to 60 days to simulate a team isolation. They also have up to year-long isolations and even longer than that at different facilities around the world. So again, it kind of depends on what it is that you want to study. But there are a lot of different ways that we can simulate different aspects of these extreme environments when we want to study them.
Really interesting stuff.
Yep. So, Ken, this question's for you. There was some recent news coverage about how tanks are being driven by artificial intelligence now and how machine guns are now being equipped with facial recognition software. Whether it's missiles or tanks, more and more weapons are being powered by artificial intelligence. And I listened to the interview that Don did with you a while back, where you said that you didn't agree with Elon Musk's rather dark vision of rogue robots going around killing people. But more and more of my friends at school buy into this idea that one day the humanoids will turn on us humans. I'm curious if your thoughts about weaponized robots and the dangers of AI have changed over the past couple of years. And what do you see as the future?
Well, first, I think there's too much science fiction influencing people's thoughts about what AI is. And people issuing warnings about the putative hazards of intelligent machines has become a booming cottage industry. Many things are dangerous. I can look around this room and see all kinds of potentially dangerous items. It's about the wisdom with which we use these things. It's not about the things themselves. So much of modern AI, for example, is essentially statistical in nature. And one would not be surprised that statistical methods can be abused. We frequently see them abused, and we've discussed this on STEM Talk. It happens all the time in the medical literature, in the pharma literature, and particularly in the nutrition literature. But it's not inherent in the technology. One wouldn't have conferences, though maybe they should, about ethics and statistics. It's more the issue, are the humans using the tool appropriately and ethically? So in this respect, this technology, as most technologies, or perhaps all technologies, are neutral and do not convey an inherent moral component. Now, whether we as a species will use our increasingly powerful tools with sufficient thoughtfulness and wisdom, that is very much in question. But that's a question about human behavior, not a question about mathematics and statistics.
This is another question for Ken. I have heard Ken interviewed on many topics, including space exploration, nutrition, exercise, and aging, among others, but not much on mental health and wellness. Ken, if you were to pick two actions to improve a person's mental health, what would they be?
Well, I'll give you a few more than two. First, and most importantly, throw away your TV. Second, limit time on social media or just get off it altogether. Take a walk in a forest. This is really good for your mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Get better sleep, have more sex, and listen to STEM Talk.
In what order?
Yeah, I'll leave that to the listener. Everyone has different priorities. But if one would only do those things, pretty simple to do. If you don't have a lovely forest nearby, a beautiful beach is just as wonderful, right? So walk on the beach, spend time in the forest, love someone, listen to STEM Talk, and throw away your TV.
So this is a question for Ken. Ken, have you ever used the Uller device, and what do you think of it?
Well, I actually have one and really like it. I used it last night. The Uller device lays over the mattress, kind of like a mattress cover, and it's able to regulate temperature up and down about 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a substantial swing in temperature. Now, it's not a substitute for AC. I know some people are thinking, oh, good, I'll just turn off my AC and I'll turn on my Uller. But I do find it quite pleasant, and it seems to improve sleep quality, not just for me, but for many people. So what's the downside? First, it's not inexpensive. It's a very well-made piece of equipment, as far as I can see, and sleep is important. So I'm willing to make that investment. And we can put a link in the show notes to their website. They make different level devices. The one I use is called Ouler, O-O-L-E-R.
I've heard it mentioned on a number of other podcasts talking about health and performance too. So thanks, Ken.
So here's another question for Don. Don, you previously talked on STEM Talk about studies you were ramping up to better understand the brain lymphatic system in extreme environments. How is your brain lymphatic research coming along? Where does it stand at this point?
Yeah, thanks for asking the listener and to Ken. It's coming along great. So we're just getting started with some studies. And I'm really excited about this because this is something that I've wanted to study since pretty much since I started here at IHMC or just beforehand, even when I was a postdoc. So I'm really excited to finally get to start looking at this in humans. So we are going to be studying how different extreme environmental exposures affect the brain lymphatic system. And so this is going to be funded by the Navy and also NASA. And so we're going to be looking at how hypoxia impacts brain lymphatics in humans, how hypercapnia, so high CO2, impacts brain lymphatic function in humans, and also looking at that across several doses. That's of interest to NASA in particular, but also to the Navy, just given different exposures for the individuals that work in space and also in the undersea or even submarine environments. So we're getting ready to get those studies kicked off. Fingers crossed that will be this summer, depending on how things go with human research protocol. But we're getting everything spun up. We're also working with a collaborator, Jeff Iliff, who is a leader in the field of brain lymphatics. He's actually the person who, one of the people who discovered the lymphatic system in animal models. And he's been doing a lot of work out of University of Washington and is collaborating with us on this project. And one thing that we really want to make sure we know is, what does normal brain lymphatic function look like? So not just lymphatic, but also meningeal lymphatics. And what does that normally look like in a healthy human at different ages? And then what does it look like over different times of day? So we know that it kind of peaks, especially lymphatic function, as far as we know, probably peaks when we're in deep sleep. So what does it look like when we're awake or when we're in different stages of over the course of the day? So when we're doing our studies, we know what normal looks like before we start saying that something's actually changed in an individual. So we're trying to work all that out right now with him. He's got some protocols that are running, and then we've got our protocols that are going to start spinning up. So we're really excited. I think this time next year, we'll have some answers as far as how these different extreme environmental exposures impact brain lymphatic flow.
Really interesting stuff, Don. And yeah. I've always thought that you should have the title The Queen of Glymph.
I will take it. So this one's for Ken. I recently heard Ken give a speech in which, among other things, he said that we should all strive to be a better animal, which seemed rather odd to me. So can you ask him to briefly explain?
A listener thinks that's rather odd. Okay. Actually, what I said is that we should all strive to be a better animal and to recognize that you are one. Some, when I gave that talk in the audience, seemed somewhat surprised and uncomfortable at the realization and my characterization of their animal status. They sort of think of it as there are animals and there are humans, and some of us make damn poor animals. I rather like being an animal, and it seems far preferable to me than to all the other options available here on Earth. So I'm good with being an animal, and I think we should all be the best animal we can be. And I'll leave it at that.
That's a good thing to aim for. So there are several activity and sleep trackers that have the form factor of a ring. And during the Peter Attia episode, Ken and Peter discussed the Oura Ring and another ring that Ken said he was evaluating. So I'm curious to know the outcome of this evaluation. Obviously, this question is for Ken.
Okay, well, I started doing an evaluation, and it was tedious. And so I didn't actually do a formal, real sort of semi-scientific comparison or evaluation, just an informal assessment of the two rings, as my user experience would illuminate. So I've had an Oura Ring for over 3 years. It's quite a popular device, and it does a number of things, including heart rate variability, activity tracking of all kinds, and of course, sleep assessments. Other ring to which I referred is marketed by a company called Sleep-On, and they seem to have two models. One is all caps, Go to Sleep, with two meaning the numeral two, Go to Sleep, and the other, Go to Sleep -SE. Now, I've not tried the Go to Sleep SE, but I've used the Go to Sleep for about 8-9 months. Interestingly, unlike the Oura Ring, these two products do not attempt to do anything but track sleep. So they're not exercise trackers, they're not activity trackers, strictly sleep. And they sort of give you a detailed sleep analysis, kind of like a less detailed version of what you might get if you went to a sleep study. And this idea of just tracking sleep suited me fine. But alas, Go to Sleep was just not up to snuff in terms of build quality, battery life, or technical support. So both the Oura Ring and Go to Sleep do a relatively poor job, I'd like to mention, in tracking the sleep, particularly REM sleep, of an active sleeper. So if you're fully paralyzed in REM, which you're supposed to be,
right.
They do fine. But if you're not fully paralyzed in REM, like if you are dreaming in REM and then have a motion associated with the dream, it doesn't have to be any big motion. The sleep trackers do a poor job and will typically think you're awake or not in REM. Recently, I had a readiness score of 82, how ready I am for the day. My sleep score was 27 because I thought I was up all night. Makes no sense. You should never have a readiness of 82 and a sleep score of 27.
There's a big gap there.
Yeah, something's wrong. So these are early days, but I do find particularly the Oura Ring somewhat useful. It's important not to obsess about it. I know somebody that I encouraged to buy an Oura Ring. He did, and it made his sleep worse. Because he fretted about it and he obsessed about it.
Right.
It didn't help. They both have relatively poor customer service. If you reach out to Oura, as I had several times, for technical difficulties, on average, took them 7 days to respond. Go to Sleep is much worse. You're dealing with someone in China. They twice told me this was the complete answer. We are on vacation. And that was the answer. Okay. Hmm. And they were on vacation for a long time. So something else that differentiates them, besides build quality and battery life, much better in Oura, is that Oura really often upgrades their software over the air. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly getting improvements and new versions. And as I said, this is early days for sleep trackers, so these improvements are welcome. So I guess between the two, it's pretty much a slam dunk. I prefer Oura, but one should realize it is early days and not expect outrageously perfect performance. It gives you an idea.
And improvements to be made down the line, too. So,
it does. Yeah. And Don was talking about glymphatic function, and this happens mostly, we think, in deep sleep. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to look at your deep sleep. And Don, is it true that, I think it was you that told me this, I just want to verify, because I sometimes spread things that are untrue by accident. Is it believed that you have better glymphatic function, better when you're sleeping on your side?
Yes.
That is true.
Okay. Yes. There's a published study out about that, actually. So,
and that's interesting.
Yep. So it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, what that means performance-wise. And just, again, as we kind of learn more about what proper glymphatic function, but also brain lymphatic function mm-hmm. means overall for our health, too. So
I was wondering if you think it's a difference that makes a difference.
Yeah, this is a great question. I think I hate taking the easy road out on this one, but I think we just don't know enough right now to know. So, yeah. But, I mean, I'm thankful that I'm a side sleeper.
Here is a good question for Don that seems like a nice follow-on to our previous question. Our listener asks, there are many companies now focused on collecting real-time or near-real-time data related to our daily health. Heart rate, sleep patterns, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see the diving community moving towards collecting physiological parameters to define things such as decompression or other diving-related risks? How does this whole phenomena connect to the diving community?
Yeah, so I think from me and also my colleagues who are researchers in the diving medicine community, every single time that we give a talk, I think this question comes up. So thanks for asking that question. So there are a number of companies that have started to integrate things like, you know, heart rate, which is tricky to measure in water, by the way. It's not something that we've really optimized at this point, but there is technology out there that's allowing us to start to capture data. We just don't know about how clean that data is in water. And also with movement, we know some of that stuff is always going to be affected. But so things like heart rate, I don't know if anything that integrates sleep patterns yet, but heart rate in particular, respiratory rate are two that I think we're starting to pay attention to. And even looking at things like real-time monitoring of bubbles in your vascular system. So it's something that has been an endpoint for decompression studies. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. I mean, it means that you have bubbles, but it doesn't mean that you have decompression sickness because people can have lots of bubbles and not have any symptoms. But it is interesting data to be collected and to build off of. I would say the biggest thing right now is that the diving studies that are done, whether it's decompression related or looking at CNS oxygen toxicity or other conditions that can come up in response to diving, first of all, we don't know that much about even just individual variability and how that affects risk with respect to, you know, decompression sickness or CNS oxygen toxicity. Then to look within an individual and start to collect this data and understand what that means as far as their individual risk factor, we really don't know. So it's definitely something that I think as more and more data is collected will be integrated into the models and we'll start to have a better understanding of what it means. But for now, it's more of an interesting tool in the diving community for people to use. But I would definitely say at this point, we're not at a place where people can use that kind of information for any kind of decision-making process or for safety parameters.
Yes, so you'll be looking at eye tracking underwater as well. Is that started yet?
Yes, so that's a study that is just recently funded by Office of Naval Research, and we're really excited about that. So we want to look at, first of all, just development of a system that you can put into a mask. So that's going to be the first piece, is just validating that we can actually capture the data we think we're capturing when you put a camera system into a mask. So they're very tiny micro cameras that would go into the lens of a mask. And the idea is that the aviation community is already working on this to look for things like hypoxia, because we know that eye movement, there are very subtle changes in eye movement that are associated with hypoxia. And so we're thinking the same thing could be in the diving setting where somebody could have either hypoxia or, again, hypercapnia, high CO2, or even potentially be at risk for something like a central nervous system oxygen toxicity seizure, which right now there are no warning signs before an individual, at least anything that can be captured through a device before an individual has an underwater seizure because they're breathing too much oxygen. So this could be a device that could capture a lot of different physiological parameters in divers. So again, a lot of validation has to take place and a lot of testing, but we're really excited about getting started with the first stage of that study to actually just get a camera system that fits into a mask and then to start collecting the data. So thanks, Ken.
Interesting.
So this is from Stella for both Don and Ken. I was at the Tommy Wood lecture he gave at IHMC where he talked about the importance of sleep and brain health. One of his many points was that if you don't want to get Alzheimer's, then be sure to get a good night's sleep. Of course, it's more complicated than that, but he drove home the point that a good night's sleep is really, really important. Since all of this coronavirus craziness, I wake up over and over in the middle of the night and have a hard time going back to sleep. So I started taking Tylenol PM before I go to bed, but Tommy said taking Ambien or other sleep aids robs the brain of the protective measures of a good night's sleep. He said there were other natural sleep aids out there. I know you've had guests that have addressed this on STEM Talk. So for those of us who are struggling to sleep during all of this coronavirus craziness, what can we do naturally before we go to bed to get a good night's sleep? And Ken, I'm going to guess first thing you're going to say is throw out your TV.
Absolutely. Think Sella, our listener's name is Sella. Think how much better you would sleep if you didn't have a television to spin you up and scare and annoy you. So get rid of your TV. What else? STEM Talk episode 11 featured Dr. Kirk Parsley, and we discussed sleep extensively during that episode. Kirk has developed a sleep supplement called Doc Parsley Sleep Remedy that some or many even have found useful. And also a very large number of people supplement with melatonin before bed. Melatonin is known to have many other beneficial effects. Excessive alcohol consumption is detrimental prior to sleep. And as we've discussed earlier, one can these days easily track their sleep with a device like an Oura Ring or some other sleep tracker. I mentioned earlier, I enjoy the Uller device, and I set it to a really low temperature, and I like to sleep in a cold black room. I guess I should winter over in Antarctica or something, but I like to set the Uller to a cold setting and a dark, dark room, a quiet, dark room. And I myself, I find it useful to have had an active day, you know, to have engaged in exercise, outdoor activity, had fresh air, and not to be eating dinner too close to sleep time. I think this is a common mistake. I think early dinners are the way to go. And as I said, to start, in the case of the reaction and the stress that people feel as the result of this strange times we're living in, I would say avoid exposure to television, partly due to the light they give, the blue light, but really mostly due to the annoying and vacuous content. So I would say avoid that. Dawn, what do you have to add?
I foot stomp everything that you just said, Ken, and I would say probably the TV has been one of the things I've learned has been the biggest impact, just turning it off and putting on some good music in the evening and winding down with good tea. I think for me, I do an Epsom salt bath. It's just something that helps relax me, but also, you know, potentially just get that relaxation going before you hop into bed. And then just keeping all the devices out of the bedroom is key. And that's really been a huge help for me in getting proper sleep. And I agree with the cold aspect. I will definitely be checking out the Uller device or something along those lines, because I know just turning down the temps has had a huge impact on my sleep quality as well.
So. Yeah, I agree. And I like you mentioned the bath, you know, float tanks are great.
Yes.
You know, the sensory deprivation along with, you know, you're essentially floating in magnesium and other salts. And, you know, you take in a lot of this transdermally.
Yes.
And if you took in this much magnesium orally, you wouldn't sleep.
Yeah,
you'd be in the other room.
Right. You'd be in the room next to your bedroom.
The small room. So magnesium is sleep inducing, but beyond a certain point, it has other consequences. So transdermally taking it, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And it's very relaxing.
I had a gap where I wasn't taking Epsom salt baths for about a month, and I did notice there's a change in my sleep quality. And it could just be anecdotal, and it could be there are other things that are going on in my life that are keeping me stressed, which is why I wasn't taking the Epsom salt baths. But I do think once I started taking them again, my sleep quality definitely improved as well. So
yeah, in the future, we're arranging a STEM Talk episode on the scientific research around the float tanks.
Fantastic. Good.
Yeah, so the whole episode will be about the science and where it's strong and where it's not strong. You know, some of the science is in its infancy and it's really unclear.
Right.
But other parts are pretty robust.
Absolutely.
We're going to look at that.
And I know you, I mean, you've been partaking in it for quite some time, and I've given it a try a number of times, and I've only said great things about it, as you have too. So it's had a very positive impact on my overall wellness. So
I think it's good.
That'd be great.
Well, Dawn, another AMA in the books.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Ken. It's
you
been
know,
fun.
AMA means ask me anything, and people do, but all those questions don't make it on the show.
We do get some interesting ones. Yeah.
Somebody asked me, is Dawn married? I get all kinds of strange questions.
So that is, some of those we will not be answering on air. Awesome. Well, thanks, Ken.
All right. Thank you.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Well, Ken, that was a lot of fun, and we get lots of requests for AMA episodes, so if you have any questions, please email us at stemtalk@ihmc.us.
Yes, Dawn, the questions for this episode I thought were particularly good, so please, listeners, keep them coming.
And if you enjoyed this interview as much as Ken and I did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage, where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes at stemtalk.us. This is Dawn Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.